Jeff Bloom joins me this week from Murphy and Rood Malting to discuss malt. This is Beersmith Podcast number 299.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit Beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 299, and it's late February 2024. Jeff Bloom joins me this week from Murphy and Rood Malting to discuss his malt house. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They invite you to join their upcoming brewery workshop, March 24th to 27th, in Austin, Texas. This one-of-a-kind event brings together professional brewers to help you start and grow your own craft brewery. To learn more, please visit breweryworkshop.com. Again, that's breweryworkshop.com. And also The Barrel Mill, creator of the Infusion Spiral, used to add flavor and aroma to wine, spirits, and beer. The unique spiral cut design creates unrivaled surface area in a small package, allowing fast extraction of the toasted oak's aroma and flavor compounds. Looking for woods other than oak? Try their exotic woods, including Amberana, American and French oak, aspen, Spanish cedar, cypress, and sugar maple. For more information, go to infusionspiral.com. Again, that's infusionspiral.com. And Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith Brewing Software. Beersmith Web lets you design great beer recipes from any browser, including your tablet or phone. Edit recipes on the go with access to the same full suite of recipe building tools as our desktop version. Try Beersmith Web by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, a reminder to click those like and subscribe buttons on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're on. Clicking those buttons is a great way to support the show. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome Jeff Bloom. Jeff is the founder and head maltster at Murphy and Rood Malting Company in Charlottesville, Virginia. They opened in 2018. Murphy and Rood is Virginia's first and one of the only dedicated commercial production specialty malt houses, and they produce a wide variety of base, high kiln, specialty, and dry roast malts for regional brewers and distillers. Jeff, it's great to have you on the show. How are you doing, man?
Good. I'm doing well. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, we last had you way back in 2020, if you can believe that, on episode number 227. It was
feels like yesterday.
So it's been almost 3 years. What have you been up to the last 3 years, and what's been happening at Murphy and Rood?
I mean, frankly, just trying to keep up. we put what I call a right sizing expansion into production about January 2023, so roughly about a year ago. And on the upside, that roughly gave us about 3x capacity expansion, which was helpful. But it was really just to bridge the capacity gap while we work on a larger capital raise for a more significant expansion this year. So with that on track, that should double our now current 300 ton capacity to just over about 750 malt tons a year. So
wow, that's substantially up for, you know, when I actually listened to the podcast from 3 years ago, a short time ago. And, I think you were doing like 100 something then, perhaps.
Yeah. We opened at about 120 tons or so.
And a lot of it was kind of cobbled together. A lot of the equipment, if I recall.
It is. Yes. We're looking forward to, as Brent Manning at Riverbend put it before their expansion, we're looking for no more duct tape.
I like duct tape. What's wrong with duct tape?
It doesn't hold together quite as well in a commercial malt manufacturing space. But, you know, we built what we could afford at the time. And frankly, I probably wouldn't do it any differently, hindsight being 2020. So I'm proud of where we started. I'm proud of where we've gotten. Proud of our plans moving forward, and we just need to focus on delivering on them, and we should be good to go.
Well, I think we'll talk a little more about the equipment changes you made later. But one of the things we discussed briefly last time is the value of malt, craft malt, versus buying from one of the big malt houses. And I think, if anything, the case has perhaps strengthened in the last few years, right?
I think it has, certainly. I think what we saw coming out of the pandemic was a significant increase in price parity between these big guys and smaller malt houses. As the big malt companies consistently and kind of over time incrementally increased their prices in the wake of post-pandemic inflation. But the point here, I think, is really not the price gap. It's really a window into the volatility of commodity markets. I mean, what's one of the values we have and missions at Murphy & Root is to really decommoditize this malt space. We may be using a commodity raw material, but we in no way believe that malt is malt as a commodity definition would suggest. So, if you look at the industry as a whole, the industry standard, a quote unquote profit margin for large malt houses is roughly 5%. Wow. Not 15, not 50, 5. So it's based on moving volume, which takes quality and the cost that comes with that out of the equation. So small houses, on the other hand, are working outside of the global commodity market volatility, working with local and regional growers and suppliers whose prices reflect the true cost. And so while many viewed craft malt, I think, in the past as just a more expensive version of the commodity stuff, what we have proven is that there's a price stability in working with more localized supply chains. Freight will always be a nightmarish game, but by pricing products by what they actually cost, we are much less susceptible to market volatility that is often driven by factors occurring far, far away from us and most often geopolitically. So with craft malt pricing falling much closer to that of the big guys, a few of those fence-sitting producers, I think, finally felt comfortable taking a shot with craft malt, and then the quality they gained made the pricing argument a nearly moot point. And then add to that the positives you gain in customer service, reestablishing the customer-supplier relationship, the marketability and storytelling that comes with more traceable products. What you get is a whole lot of aha moments. And so I really think craft malt's benefited from that.
Now, I had a maltster from Germany on a few weeks back, and he was getting really hard. Yeah, they were getting hit really very, very hard, not only at the farmer end, if you will, just the cost of fertilizer and everything goes into the farming has gone way up, but also the cost of energy has gone up dramatically in Germany. Have you seen your wholesale cost, your input cost, rise significantly?
We have. It has trickled up. Grain, we saw those price increases. I mean, our growers, are informed by the commodity market, just for fair pricing purposes. But most certainly the fertilizer costs that were ridiculous during the pandemic and soon after it certainly bumped those prices up. That being said, in the grand scheme of things, grain cost is not the primary driving factor in the cost of malt. Yes, it goes up and then your margin goes down. But getting to this, pricing things for what they, based on what they cost, by functioning as a non-commodity based business, and, yes, we factor in slightly higher margins in some cases, we can absorb a bit more when we're talking, our grain cost went up by a couple few cents. Mm-hmm. And yes, the volatility of utility inputs, electricity, natural gas, propane, that can also play a part. But then while we are also, and this is probably specific to us, but as we are increasing in capacity, we also realize some manufacturing efficiencies. We can make more we can make twice as much malt with not twice as many gigawatts of electricity. And so by not abiding by these razor thin margins that really prioritize, force us to move these massive amounts of volume, we can absorb a bit more of that and not necessarily pass that on. And in the case of us, I mean, we were able to expand in January. That gave us almost a 3x capacity boost. Frankly, we were able to introduce some pricing tiers that actually lowered costs based on, you know, slightly higher commitments from our customers. But there's this margin phenomenon within our space that, you know, as you get larger on in production capacity, you don't necessarily need to then hire 2, 3, 4 times as many employees. And so you can control your labor costs and be a little bit leaner there and increase margins while also reducing prices, believe it or not. And so I think it's, you know, in some cases a perfect storm, but you know, we did see a lot of the same things, but we didn't necessarily have to act the same way.
Well, you said a lot of pro brewers are turning to craft malting. Can you make the case for why a home brewer might want to experiment with craft malt as opposed to going with, you know, the big suppliers that are available pretty widely at their homebrew store?
Yeah. And frankly, homebrewers have always been one of our biggest champions. You know, as soon as we started, I mean, I credit a lot of the word to mouth evangelical, you know, encouragement that that the commercial side received. A lot of that was coming from the home brewer side of things. I mean, we certainly in Virginia have a home brewer community that's pretty tightly woven in with the commercial side. Some of the more adamant home brewers have pretty close relationships with their local commercial breweries. And so we have always seen interest in craft malt from the home brewer market. It was really mostly about executing on fulfillment there. But let's pretend we had not seen that. And why would a home brewer want to look into craft malt? And it really, for one thing, comes down to differentiation. The argument's pretty low hanging fruit for a commercial outfit, but even at the home brewer level, especially those active in competition circuits or perhaps those with plans that are trying to make a name for themselves, differentiation wins medals, it attracts attention, it conveys purpose, and all of those things are what can set you aside from your competition.
Yeah. And as you pointed out, homebrewers are very much enjoy experimenting. So
absolutely,
that's a big plus to try something they maybe, you know, really can't get otherwise.
Yeah, and I think it's on the malt companies. Yes, we distribute, Murphy & Rude distributes to our local homebrew supply shop. They can be very difficult to get into. They don't have a lot of extra space. They're very, very price sensitive. Because they're also trying to provide homebrewers with the other 150 bazillion malts that are made worldwide. Because, you know, when a homebrew recipe says it has to be Bohemian Pilsner, it just has to be Bohemian Pilsner.
Of course, of course. Yeah.
And so they can be difficult to get into. And so, you know, craft maltsters are in homebrew shops, some more than others. And so they are available there. They are oftentimes come at a significant price premium. But you can still keep your eye out for folks like us in your local homebrew shop. Most certainly any that are online can be helpful. And then, as I think we'll probably touch on at some point, we're trying to address this issue ourselves too.
Yeah. Well, this kind of leads into the next topic. One of the topics you wanted to discuss was how the large suppliers often confuse brewers with all their branding and fancy names. You know, they put names on all the different malts to differentiate from their competitors. I was wondering if you could start with a brief description, maybe a short tutorial of the key malt specifications that really differentiate different kinds of malt.
Sure. So, I mean, big malt, because they rely almost exclusively on distribution networks to move their products. They are in a major brand loyalty battle here against each other. And so hence the naming game, extra special this, special letter, whatever, B, W, C, Kara something.
Something X, something Y.
Right. So as brewers, we should really be focused on three primary malt specs. Color, so this is directly correlated to flavor, and then extract and diastatic power or starch converting power. Mm-hmm. And with that latter one really should heavily influence grist percentage decisions. So there are a number of other factors like friability, lauterability, so like beta glucan levels, soluble protein levels, aka S over T or the Kolbach index, and yeast nutrition. But for the purposes of this discussion, let's assume these are all within acceptable levels. You know, any functionally minded maltster would ensure that these specs are in place, and these specs are actually really more helpful to the maltster by informing us whether we did a good job or not, and are not necessarily something that we expect brewers or certainly at the homebrew level to really dial in on. Many
right, of these but are not can available. You talk? Can you go through the big three again and maybe explain kind of what they are and where they are on the sheet and what they might look like?
Sure. So, I mean, if we're looking at color, that's usually right at the top there, right along moisture.
So Lovibond, right? Mostly.
Right. So we're typically talking in either Lovibond or SRM. There's conversions out there, but
European, I think it's EBC, right?
European is EBC, correct. Yeah, and so we have a tintometer at the malt house that is based in EBC, and then we make the conversion to Lovibond. But as maltsters, we're typically operating in the Lovibond scale, whereas brewers are in finished beer color, typically working in SRM. But color, again, that's going to be your primary driver within your brewing software to really dial in where your end beer color is going to be. But it's important to note that it is directly correlated with flavor. It is impossible to have a very flavorful but very light colored malt. And so as you get up in color, your flavor intensity, your aroma intensity begins to increase along with that color piece. So we're gonna focus on that when trying to kind of demystify a lot of these naming conventions. Getting to the extract side, you know, there's a big dividing point. Base malts are typically, you know, those are typically your lightest. Those prioritize high extract, and we're typically talking, you know, over 80% extract. And whereas the darker color specialty or character malts are not necessarily relied on for their extract. They do provide a wee bit, but they're typically used in such small volumes that they don't make a big difference in the overall ABV formula or algorithm. And then the diastatic or starch converting power. So this is where we're looking at DP or alpha amylase levels. These are telling us whether this particular malt is going to convert starches to sugar in the mash. And so those are a big difference between a base malt. You get kind of like a 50-50 effect in high kilned malts. And then as you get into dry roasts, those diastatic powers plummet and are certainly not relied on for starch conversion.
Most specialty malts really don't provide much in the way of enzymes, right?
No. I mean, dry roasted malts, even the lightest, you know, drum roasted malts, the drum roaster temperatures have far exceeded any temperature stability range of any given enzyme. So those are typically denatured in the drum. Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, you need some base malt, especially if you're like a partial mash kind of guy. You need some base malt really to convert the starch, right?
Absolutely. So yeah. Your base malt's your main, you know, starch converting powerhouse. There are malts, particularly, you know, darker Munichs that may have enough diastatic power to convert themselves, but they can't be relied on to convert anything else. And so you certainly need to be looking at diastatic power if you are adding any unmalted adjuncts, raw wheat, flaked oats, you know, any other flaked raw grain, which certainly can help in developing body in beer and helping with foam creation and head retention, but need to have their starches converted by another source, and that is where your base malt is coming in.
Mm-hmm. As I understand it, there's four basic types of malt. Can you walk us through the four basic types?
Yeah. So let's break this really into four primary categories. And so we've got base malts, high kiln malts, roasted malts, and then what I'll call the hybrids. And so these are where like the Special Bees, the Red X, the Cara Bohemian, or whatever you want to add there. And so that hybrid, is that fourth category of the somewhat unknown. So starting with base malts, these are the lighter color, again, lighter flavor malts that prioritize enzyme package and extract levels. Mm-hmm. The color sphere here is about, generally less than 2 lovibond to maybe, 3 to 3.5, or, greater than 3 lovibond. The second category, high kiln malts, these are your Viennas, your Munichs of the world, and in some cases, some of these aromatic melanoidin malts, maybe even biscuit malt, depending on how a given malt producer makes their biscuit malt. These go through a more customized kiln schedule to drive Maillard and melanoidin development, and some are still diastatic. I mean, Vienna malts are diastatic, light Munichs are diastatic. Typically, those malts are in the range of maybe 4 to 7 lovibond. So you can consider those, character base malts, if you will. So they will carry some conversion power with them. Once we progress past the 4 to 7 lovibond color specs and into kind of 10 to 20 lovibond color specs, we start losing diastatic power. The higher the kiln temp, the more enzymes we denature. And so we start getting into malts that can only convert themselves or nothing at all. These are not functional base malts and are really better relied on for color and flavor than conversion.
So the darker kiln malts, I think the darkest would be maybe like a brown malt. Would that be considered a kiln malt at that point, or is it roasted?
I would consider a brown malt a dry roasted. The days of diastatic brown malt are over.
Yeah.
I would encourage us not to go back to those days. They involved open flames and malt catching on fire. And so asking a maltster to recreate a diastatic brown malt.
Yeah, I mean, as a historical note, that was the primary ingredient in porter for many years, right? Back to the 1700s.
Right. But let's remember, those were not homogenous or uniform brown malts. These are malts that part of the piece caught on fire because
most of them weren't kilned over. Most of them were kilned over fire. They were not kilned over coke yet, for most part.
Correct. And so, there's guys in there trying to keep this stuff mixed up enough so that it doesn't catch on fire. And so a diastatic brown malt really is half burned and half not. So that's where you get your, color and, diastatic.
Moving on from the kiln malts, we get into the roasted malts. So, you describe those?
Right. So dry roast. So these are the true character malts and include everything from, in our case, biscuit, amber, brown malts to chocolate and black malts. And I'm going to include crystals in this category since those are produced in the roaster at some point. And so dry roasts should be considered non-diastatic. The drum roaster temps, like I mentioned, are even the lightest dry roast exceed enzyme stability temps. And so these are really developed exclusively for color and flavor, and in the case of a few, body development. But these colors really in dry roasted are ranging from 20, 25 lovibond. So those are like your biscuit level malts, to 300, 400 plus lovibond when you get into chocolate and black malts.
And there's very few made in the roughly 70 to 200 lovibond range, right? Because we call that kind of the harsh zone, right?
Yeah, there's a
handful of crystal malts made in that range, but that's about it, I think.
Right. So we certainly have that range colored in the crystal side of things, mostly driven by caramelization of sugars, but in the dry roasting world, there is kind of this like no man's land of, you know, high, maybe 80s to high 100s, where you can really get into this like acidic kind of tangy nature that they provide. And so you're typically not seeing a lot of dry roasted, drum roasted malts in that color.
I think Randy Mosher coined the term harsh zone. He calls that the harsh zone. And there really aren't any malts made in that zone, except, as you pointed out, the crystal ones. So.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. The next I want to talk about crystal malts. They are made in a slightly different way. Can you describe that?
Yeah, and I think there's some nomenclature confusion here too. I mean, they're often referred to as crystal malts or caramel malts.
Caramel, yeah.
Generally speaking, the Europeans, they kind of use that term interchangeably. Whereas on the American side of things, we really view them differently. So a crystal malt is what we would consider a very homogeneously glassy, well gelatinized, specialty malt. Whereas a caramel malt is oftentimes we are trying to achieve roughly the same effect, but do so in the kiln. And for those who are perhaps familiar with a malt kiln, we essentially place the grain on a perforated floor and force indirect heated air up through that floor. And so the kiln dries unevenly. So the bottom gets dry well before the top of the piece does. And so you are inherently non-homogeneous in doing that kilning process. Yes, some kilns have screws or turning mechanisms that can mix some things up a little bit. But generally speaking, drum roasters are much more thoroughly homogeneous and uniform in their heat application. And so caramel malts, typically, if you're speaking from the American viewpoint, caramel malts are sweeter malts produced in the kiln, where we gelatinize the vast majority of those starches, and we then add additional heat in the kiln and caramelize those into sweeter flavor notes. Crystal malts, and on the other hand, are gelatinized within the drum roaster, so they get much more even delivery of heat, and so those kernels are gelatinized in a much more homogeneous, uniform way. And then that gelatinized malt is then dehydrated and then typically re-roasted back up to higher temperatures to get those different color specs. So crystal 10, crystal 15, 20, 40, 60, 80, 120, 150. We developed a seasonal release crystal malt at a whopping 260 Lovibond, but it tastes like s'mores. And so you're typically allowed to play with a lot more in the color realm with crystal malts. But certainly worth noting that there is, depending on geographic origin, oftentimes a difference between a crystal and a caramel.
Interesting. And then I think the last group you mentioned was sort of these one-off kind of oddball malts, right?
Right. And so these can be a little difficult. They can differ significantly between companies. They're brutal when it comes to names, and because unlike dry roast, they look at flavor contributions more than necessarily a rule in color spec. So some of these, particularly like this Dingaman Special B or Special W from Vireman, these can resemble almost what you would think is like a malt blend or hybrids between a high kilned Maillard forward malt and a sweeter character malt or sweeter caramel crystal malt. You know, the Special B, the Special W, the Brees Extra Special, these have a little of both, both melanoidin heavy and sweeter caramel crystal notes to them. Whereas things like a Brees Special Roast For instance, is really, in my opinion, just an aromatic malt, aka an intense biscuit malt. And so you really need to focus heavily on the flavor component that these are providing. The color should probably be secondary when you're looking at it, to understand really what you're trying to use here. When you get into things like color specific malts, like the Red X's of the world, and I can only theorize here, but these are really very likely very high protein barley malts that are used to produce this. So high protein delivers reddish hues in general, but that they can carry the color while still being diastatic. I think that's one of the kind of the fascinating things about Red X, is that it can be used like well above 80% grist. And so, you know, enzymes are proteins. So high protein barley produces enough of an enzyme package that more of those enzymes can survive a slightly higher kilning regimen that is needed to produce the red color. Yeah. And so you really need, again, the fact that it's red is not necessarily helpful to you, nor would the diastatic power really be. I think what you're really looking for in these hybrid malts is what kind of flavor component am I trying to capture with these given ones, as opposed to trying to figure out what the equivalent version is at a different malt house. It can get very, 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 very confusing.
So how do you kind of cut through all the nonsense? And because we got, you know, all these different groupings, we've got brand names put on top of them. How do you do that?
Yeah. So by focusing on color, and then also considering whether you are using an American or European malt supplier, it can really help you deduce a couple important things, mainly flavor and functionality. So it's within these two spaces where things can get confusing in these naming conventions. What does it taste like and how does it work? But we can tease out the answer to that, like, what is it question, if we pay enough attention to color and perhaps the origin of that particular malt. So just quickly, within base malts, we've got three main players within the base malt realm here: Pilsner malts, pale or quote unquote lager malts, and then pale ale malts. And so oftentimes pale and pale ale can be used interchangeably. They are not the same. Pilsner malts, you know, these are dependably under 2 Lovibond and just barely over it. And they're really meant for finesse lager brewing. Things that where you cannot hide, the mash outcome with, you know, heavy IBU driving, early boil hop or aromatic hop additions through dry hopping. The flavor elements of Pilsner malts, earthiness, a little bit of minerality, some light cracker, maybe some dry grass notes. Yes, they are a great choice for hazy IPA because they are rendered completely irrelevant flavor-wise, given their light color and the level of dry hopping going on to produce those copious hop aromatics and biotransformation-derived haze. But generally speaking, Pilsner malts are for, very touchy finesse lager brewing. Pale malts, historically speaking, American pale malt and European Pilsner malts are in essence the same thing. Old world American pale malts are a relic of the macro lager brewing era and were held to a very, very light color spec. So they always had to be under 2 Lovibond. Mm-hmm. But that might sound familiar. So we just went through Pilsner malts that are, really expected to be under 2 Lovibond. These days, pale malts are best given a little bit of grace in the color department to deliver the slightly sturdier, bready notes. And so really in a pale malt, you're probably looking somewhere between 2 and 3. Anything under 2 Lovibond, really consider it in your mind a Pilsner malt. There is a difference between a Pilsner and a pale malt. The pale malt's got a little bit more of that bready piece. And then we get into pale ale malts. So these are, also known as English pale malt. They're your British style ale malts, most recognized by the names Maris Otter and Golden Promise. These are 3 to 3.5, maybe 4 Lovabond. Mm-hmm. Flavors are bready with a little bit of accompanying nuttiness. I try to tell people to think about grape nuts. So no one but British maltsters have Maris Otter malt. It's a highly, highly proprietary European malt variety that will not be given over to many. And so, you know, the flavor of those malts are really variety derived.
So it's really tied to the barley, I guess they use underlying barley. Yeah,
exactly. So Maris Otter and Golden Promise, those are variety names. So those are the name of the barley variety that they were grown, and they carry a lot of that nuttier, character, you know, more pronounced bread character. Whereas on the American side, we try to kind of emulate that effect through slightly higher kiln cure temps.
Now, have you? This is just a side question, but have you gotten into any of the heirloom variety, you know, barleys, or have you played with any of the new barleys coming out?
We have. So, you know, Virginia, we now are celebrating the arrival of Avalon, which was developed by Virginia Tech and released just about a year ago commercially. We got our hands on our first contracted acreage, so commercially available malt or grain this year. So we've, you know, certainly been working through breeder seed and seed increases up to you know, foundation seed, and then it goes to commercial availability. So it's very, very fun. Heirloom varieties can be a little harder to find in our region. Oftentimes they are, you know, primarily grown for feed. And so some of those have kind of gone undocumented, if you will, and are hard to kind of tease out of the minutiae of history. Mm-hmm. There are other small grains. You know, we have a lot of heirloom corn here. So those have been very, very fun to play with the Bloody Butchers of the world, but then also some hand-selected varieties that we work with our, you know, specific growers with that hand-select based on, you know, kernel dimensions and millability and color, and then can kind of segregate and purify certain lines to look a certain way. And so those can be really interesting, both in color and in flavor, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks. I wanted to go back again to differentiating the malts. You went through the pale malts. Can you walk through some of the other malts and how you might be able to tell what the brand name actually is underneath?
Right. And so in this particular area, it's helpful to look at geographic origin. So these can high kiln. So again, Viennas, Munichs, these can differ significantly between American and European producers. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, European companies are typically a full malt type below where the equivalent American version lands. So for instance, Vienna, an American Vienna or European Vienna malt, can often resemble that of a pale ale malt. So in that area of 3 to 5.5 Lovabond, English pale malts, while European light Munich malt, so Munich 1, for instance, can be very similar in color and flavor to an American Vienna malt. So, and then again, European dark Munich often tracks with American light Munich. So if you categorize a Vienna malt, just for purposes of this conversation, if you categorize a Vienna malt within the color level of 4, so 4.1 to 4.9,
sure,
and Munich light and dark in the range of 5 to 10, you can generally draw an informed conclusion as to what you are, you know, what you are using in your own terms. And so you can't necessarily swap an American Munich 1 with a European Munich 1. They are very likely to be different colors.
Interesting. And does that carry over into the roasted malts as well?
Roasted malts can be, Yes and no. So dry roasted, look to the color here, definitely not the name. amber malts, for instance, can vary widely in color spec. You know, a Dutch maltster can consider an amber malt to be 65, whereas we consider an amber malt to be 35. So you don't necessarily know by the word amber what color malt you're actually getting. It's much more important for you to pay attention to the color for purposes of your recipe development. And then again, while European pale chocolate malts, they can really pack more of a coffee punch than chocolate. I mean, I myself fell into this trap when trying to, you know, back in 2018, we're trying to name our malts with familiar nomenclature so people know what they're getting. Our milk chocolate, which is considered a pale chocolate malt, will soon be getting a new name as Americano roast. I mean, it punches a much, much heavier dark coffee, dark roast coffee note. There is a little bit of chocolate on the tail end there, but our Baker's Cocoa chocolate malt, our dark chocolate malt, is much more chocolate delivering than our pale chocolate. So
yeah, well, this is something I've been talking about for years, the light chocolate malt, because it's closer to that harsh zone, carries much harsher notes than the darker chocolate malt, which a lot of people find counterintuitive, you know.
It does. And let this also be known, it was called pale chocolate malt because of the color that it looked like coming out of the roaster. It not because it tasted necessarily like a light bar of chocolate. Like,
well, this is true. This is true for all light chocolate malt. It's close to that harsh zone, so it's harsher than the regular or dark chocolate. So
absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's kind of misnamed. Unfortunately, a lot of malts are even traditional naming are misnamed, really, in a lot of ways.
Couldn't agree more. Yeah. Couldn't agree more. And then I think we've already kind of talked about the hybrids. I mean, these are absolutely brutal when it comes down to like what in God's name is Red X? And you really got to look at the malt specs to figure out, okay, I think I'm dealing with, a higher protein red hue. Do I really want to use this at 85% grist? Maybe not.
Yeah.
So, while it is diastatic enough to be used at 85% grist, that doesn't necessarily mean you should. And so that's, you're now informing yourself to make informed decisions on your recipe development.
Sure, sure. Well, thanks for covering those. I appreciate it. I wanted to go through and talk a little bit about what's going on at Murphy and Root again. Can you go through, for example, I was kind of interested, I know you've done a lot of expansion. How has your malting process evolved in the last few years since we last spoke?
So up to this point, it's remained generally the same. I mean, we are a separate vessel, Saladin germination focused malt house. I mean, I guess I just like it that way. We steep in a separate vessel, we germinate in a separate vessel, and we kiln in a separate vessel. And so, as it's probably been covered here, there's a billion different ways to malt when it comes down to process and equipment. And when we built the malt house, we really just focused on making each vessel particularly good at the one thing that it needs to do. As we continue to add capacity, that inherently needs to change. As you can probably imagine, our steep tank's pretty good at steeping, our germ room's pretty good at germinating barley, and our kiln is pretty good at kilning it. But when it comes down to material handling, moving, the batch needs to be moved in between both of those pieces of equipment. And so, it's pretty intense labor. It's a lot of shoveling and a lot of time. And so this is when you start to really look into semi-combined equipment. I mean,
all the big mile houses, I think, all use sort of one thing that could do a lot of it, right?
Yeah, most of the big guys are either using Saladin boxes like we are, or they are using what you would term kind of tower malting, whereas you steep in one vessel and then you move it to a single piece of equipment that can germinate and kiln at this you know, interchangeably. And so those are called GKVs, germination kiln vessels. And you can deliver, you can build a GKV in many different, ways. And tower malting, you know, and during germination, the air, the cool, humid air is forced in through the top. Whereas then when it gets switched to kilning, that gets shut off. And then they bring dry, heated air up from underneath. And so you can dry the piece in the same place that it was germinating. We're most likely going to go the kind of a Saladin style GKV, where we just don't have to move the batch from germination into kilning, though it won't necessarily operate the same as a tower malting configuration. And so this really gets into like analyzing bottlenecks and the sequence of batches and the time in between each one and how quickly you can turn over one to start another. When you're in a separate vessel manufacturing environment, like we are, you're constantly battling bottlenecks, and then you're constantly battling getting one batch out of the way for the next. And so that is where you then start to, it makes a lot more sense to start combining some of these malting steps into a single vessel. Now, on the same time, there are some vessels that will steep and germinate in the same vessel, and then you kiln in a separate kiln. And so again, there's many, many, many combinations. It really comes down to a whole lot of factors. But again, up to this point, we've been generally sticking to the Saladin style. I certainly love how that production operates and the malt quality that comes out of it. But we're going to start evolving a little bit in how we run, how we develop some of this equipment for sure.
Now, Jeff, we're getting near the end, but I wanted to give you a few minutes here at the end to talk about your new grain store. I know that's one of the big important announcements you have.
Yeah. So this is a move I've been wanting to make for a while. I mean, I think at the beginning of the show, we kind of talked about how it's really on the malt house to, you know, help make their products available at the home brewer level. I mean, we've gotten so much traction from homebrewers. Again, they've been huge brand champions for us, and we've always had a lot of traction and interest from them. But it was just always very, very hard to fulfill homebrew orders at the wholesale format that we were in. I mean, we're bagging into 50s, and you know, having to break bags or asking homebrewers to buy significantly more than they were really looking to purchase. And so, as part of expanding our facility here in Charlottesville, we essentially expanded to the neighboring 6,000 square feet. So we certainly rent, but we now operate within a full 12,000 square foot building. A portion of that is being dedicated to a retail side of our business. And so we are doing that both on site for pickup and then through e-commerce through our website. And so doesn't matter where you are. You don't necessarily have to be in Virginia. You certainly don't have to be local in Charlottesville here. You can go on our website. It's called The Grain Store. It's got a big blinking arrow for homebrewers. Yeah,
give us the website. The website address is thegrainstore.com, or was it?
No, it's murphyroodmalting.com /shop. But if you just go to murphyroodmalting.com, you will see up there The Grain Store. It's got a blinking arrow for homebrewers. Click on that. You can place your order in either per pound increments, or we also have prepackaged 5, 10, and 25, and then also 50 pound bag availability. The 50 pound bags will sell at the same wholesale price that we would give our primary tier priced commercial accounts. And so it's what we want to do is provide access to craft malt to the population that we believe are our biggest believers, and those are the home brewers, and they should have just as much access to highly traceable, high quality, purposeful malt that commercial brewers have access to. And so we're,
I mean, this is great for commercial brewers too, because they can order enough for a pilot batch, for example.
That is correct. So we can, particularly in Virginia, it comes down to a tax exempt categorization, but it allows you to really dial in the amounts that you have, and no longer having to kind of top off, particularly with commercial brewers, having to top off pallets with like four bags of black malt that's going to take you 2 years to burn through. It can really make your ordering more efficient. But this retail side, this grain store, is really truly built for the home brewer, the home brewer market, and the home brewer customer that we so much appreciate. And I just don't think that they've been given enough attention. If set up appropriately, I think this can really be a good thing for allowing access to these newer brewing ingredients that, unfortunately, I think were kind of hands off in the early years of craft malt.
Well, mention the website one more time, and then I wanted to get your closing thoughts, Jeff.
So it's, again, murphyroodmalting.com/shop, or just go to murphyroode.com and click on grain store. You can select pickup if local, or delivery. We'll drop it at your door via UPS or FedEx or whatever carrier. This retail side of the space actually is a component of a larger customer experience center that we're really trying to build within Murphy and Rude, to give folks the opportunity to see, to taste our malts, to have a more enjoyable place to do some sensory work with potential customers. We are going to provide some of our customer beers on tap so that folks can also see the impact of our products through a professionally brewed product.
So if you happen to be near Charlottesville, right, Virginia, you can swing by, right?
Not quite yet. We're still doing the leasehold improvements on the in-store, the storefront piece. But this is going to be, we're not just expanding capacity, we're expanding experience and, the educational information side of malting. And I think it's going to be a fun time to be in Charlottesville.
Well, Jeff, really appreciate you coming on the show. It's been a pleasure having you again.
It's always great to be with you, Brad. Thanks a lot.
My guest today is Jeff Bloom. He's the founder and head maltster at Murphy and Rude Malting Company in Charlottesville, Virginia. Thank you again, Jeff.
Thank you.
A big thank you to Jeff Bloom for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They invite you to join their upcoming brewery workshop, March 24th to 27th in Austin, Texas. This one-of-a-kind event brings together professional brewers to help you start and grow your own craft brewery. To learn more, please visit breweryworkshop.com. Again, that's breweryworkshop.com. And also The Barrel Mill, creators of the Infusion Spiral, used to add flavor and aroma to wine, spirits, and beer. Their unique spiral cut design creates unrivaled surface area in a small package, allowing fast extraction of the toasted oak's aroma and flavor compounds. Looking for woods other than oak? Try their exotic woods. They offer spirals made from Arborana, American French oak, aspen, Spanish cedar, cypress, and sugar maple. For more information, go to infusionspiral.com. Again, that's infusionspiral.com. And Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith Brewing Software. Beersmith for the Web lets you design great beer recipes from any browser, including your tablet or phone. Edit recipes on the go with access to the same full suite of recipe building tools as our desktop version. Try Beersmith Web today by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, a reminder to click that like and subscribe button on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're on. Clicking those buttons is a great way to support the show. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.